coming, everyone. Welcome to the Cracked Movie Club. I'm Abe Epperson, and I direct videos at Cracked.
I'm Tom Ryman. I do other things there.
And we're taking over this week's Cracked Live podcast, and we're going to talk about Point Break 1991 by Kathryn Bigelow, continuing our September Bigelow month.
That's right.
And for those who aren't familiar with this podcast, we choose a director every month, and then we talk about their movies, the behind the scenes and such, and then do some jokes and observations, hopefully. Along with us are our guests, Soren Bowie, Carmen Angelica, Cracked writer-performer fame.
Yeah.
So Point Break.
Yeah, for our first live Cracked Movie Club. I feel like we get a little more energy in there.
Yeah. You two, I have a question for you. When is the first time that you watched this movie?
Let's see. I didn't see it when it came out because I can't ever remember being in a theater and seeing it. But my brother, I think, rented it with his friends when I was a kid. I was in, I would have been in probably elementary school, and my brother rented it. And I remember being a little bit afraid during the heist scenes where they had the masks on as the presidents. That freaked me out a little bit.
Were you afraid of like the concept of crime, or was it the masks?
It was really the eerie mask that they wore with the no eyes behind the face. Yeah.
And the mouth kind of moves, but only when Swayze talks.
Yeah.
And I have a long history with this movie. I watched it for the first time when they asked me to do this podcast. In fact, I wasn't totally sure. They just said that Gary Busey was in it, and Reeves was in it, and Swayze was in it. And then I watched the wrong one that was made in 2015. And I was just watching and being like, where's Gary Busey? I'm just seeing a bunch of like very ripped men doing like tricks. And then I looked it up and it was like, oh, it's the one that's 1992.
Doing tricks?
Doing tricks, yeah.
Just doing tricks. Like doing that was what it looked
tricks,
like.
Tricks, yeah. You know.
I bet a lot of you idiots want to take your applause back now.
No, I don't think they do. I think they're with me on the tricks because they're doing it very crazy tricks.
They are.
Also, shirtless. Just shirtless dudes.
I already mentioned that they were ripped, and I was like actually appreciative. I was like, yeah. This is a joke from you guys. Thank you.
Yeah.
This is a good time for Carmen.
Well, we got Carmen to watch a bunch of half-naked men.
at what point did you realize that you were watching the wrong film?
Well, I got to the point where it was like they explained the whole reason for the film, which is a different concept, guys. It has a whole different complicated thing where they're like trying to do the best of the most adrenaline-y tricks they could do in the world. And then I was pretty much sitting there being like, I feel like there's got to be a different option. And I looked up Point Break, and I was like, when do they come in the plot? And then I saw there was another movie with their faces on the cover of the movie. And then I was like, oh, I'm going to pause this and watch the other one, and I'll finish the ripped men later.
So wait, you returned to the other one later.
Oh, yeah.
You were like,
I mean, I don't
on
know.
Hold.
They're attractive
not
as
cut
hell.
Off.
And I have to. Like, I had to. I started it. You can't start a movie and then not
later.
Finish it.
And the plot of the remake is who can do the best trick?
Yeah. No, it's who does the most adrenaline-y trick. So, it's the ones in the world.
It's just a really elaborate game of horse.
You guys need to watch it. I can't explain it for you.
I really got to move on. This is.
I want the entire podcast to be this.
I love it to death. That was a great answer to the question, when is the first time you watched this movie? But can one of you two, I'm looking at someone in particular, give a summary of the film since you love it so much.
Ideally, trade off each sentence.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah
every
yeah,
other
yeah,
word.
Yeah,
yeah.
A little, yeah.
Yeah, yeah so a young upstart FBI agent, a blue flame special, shows up at the FBI headquarters in LA, and there's been all these bank robberies, and no one can figure out where these guys are. They're like ghosts. They show up for 90 seconds, they rob the place, and they get out of there. Not unlike Heat, I now realized.
Yep.
And then one of the FBI agents who's been chasing bank robbers for 60 years or however old Gary Busey is, figures out that they're probably surfers. And everyone else in the agency laughs at him that he thinks that these guys are trying to live this like never-ending summer where they're just traveling around and living off the money they steal from banks. And then Keanu Reeves has to become a surfer to investigate this and try and become a mole within their system and take them down from the inside.
Naturally.
That's a good sum up.
Those are the events of Point Break.
Yeah, you have seen the film. This is verified. So on this show, if people in the audience don't know, what we like to do is compare your plot description to a few of our own horrible, horrible summaries of our own.
Well, reductive.
Yeah, reductive, I guess. But we feel free to join us on our segment of terrible log lines.
A man is really excited about being late for work.
Rookie FBI agent can't solve his first case. Quits.
Angry FBI agent on a mission to stop bank robbers but gets distracted by surfing and skydiving.
Yeah.
That's actually like a better summation of the movie than what I gave at the beginning of
right,
this. That's perfect.
Ex-quarterback slash lawyer slash FBI undercover agent slash surfer slash skydiver with a knee injury is a character Hollywood thinks is believable and we fell for it.
Keanu Reeves and Patrick Swayze struggle not to kiss for 2 hours and decide to trade haircuts instead.
That's
totally true.
They totally traded haircuts.
Group of adrenaline junkies live like they could die tomorrow, then die tomorrow.
All right, angry FBI agent gets into a fast and furious situation, but with surfing.
Yes.
I understand that Fast and Furious came out after the case, but I've watched Fast and Furious before this movie.
These are all true statements.
I still feel like they could have put that on the poster and people would have been like, sounds interesting.
Fast and Furious?
Yeah,
okay.
Carmen, you actually spoiled one of like my main things that I was going to say, which is it's literally a copy-paste. Fast and Furious, they just remade Point Break.
Well, call me Carmen the Spoiler.
So, but instead of like surfing...
No, I don't think that one's going to stick.
Cars. It is.
No, it's great. That's great. All right, that ends that. So let's dive into the movie itself and the making of it in a segment we like to call expensive pretending. Because that's, right. That's what filmmaking is, I guess.
Yeah.
Expensive pretending. Do you have anything for this, Tom?
Yeah. The screenwriter for this movie is a guy named, the guy who originally came up with the story is a guy named Rick King. He got the idea watching surfers at the beach and was like, what if an FBI agent had to be one of those? And then he convinced the studio by bringing them his idea along with an article that he had that claimed that LA was the bank robbing capital of the world. And he's like, one of these two things were the same thing. And they were like, we like this idea. We're going to hire this guy to write it. So they hired this writer named Peter Ilev, or Ilev, however you pronounce that. I don't know. Is he here? Pete's not here. He was waiting tables at the time, but apparently he had done a couple of drafts before of movies that these guys liked. So they hired him to write the script, and he did a couple of drafts of it, and it originally got picked up by Ridley Scott.
And they only paid him $6,000.
Yeah, but this is in like 1980s money.
So yeah, so $10 million?
Sure.
I don't actually know how money works. So the final script also was James Cameron and Catherine Bigelow were married at this time. And so they actually co-wrote the final script, even though like they took the script and then they just processed through it.
Yeah.
It was originally about skateboarding. It wasn't about surfing.
Yuck.
So right. They were doing sick ollies, not catching crazy waves.
You figure like Gleaming the Cube came out and they got cold feet. They were like, oh, we can't compete with that. We better change the premise of this film altogether.
Wait, so it had skateboarding originally, but was there still skydiving?
I don't know. I never read it.
Like, how do you go from like skateboarding to skydiving? Like, how do you like make
same way you go from surfing to skydiving?
I also assume a plane?
Yeah,
is
probably.
That what she's asking?
Planes are
I think you're taking my arbitrary question very literally.
Very literally.
I'm saying it's one little thing to like one big drop.
You're very right about it.
I like to think that this was James Cameron's first kind of foray into his interest in the ocean. That like he just started out on the beach and was like, you know what? I think the ocean has more to offer. And then just keep going into his deep submarine down into the depths.
You know that he has the world record for the deepest man? Mm-hmm. Like he's gone the deepest over everyone.
Yeah, he's got that.
2012.
I was going to say, you can't mean like metaphysically deeply because I specifically remember a line from Titanic where Leonardo DiCaprio says, I'm just a tumbleweed tumbling in the wind. Very shallow. Very shallow man is Jim Cameron. I don't want to talk about Jim Cameron.
Yeah, is James Cameron here?
Is it Jim?
James, could you stand up? James,
no. Unfortunately, we mentioned in the most recent episode, because Catherine Bigelow was married to James Cameron for really a brief period of time, but like he sort of kind of definitely overshadows a lot of her early work, and this is certainly a case of it, because when the film was originally picked up by Ridley Scott, the option it expired, which meant that the amount of time they had to make the movie, they ran out of time, so the deal fell through, and that's when Jim Cameron and Catherine Bigelow swooped in and picked it up. And she wanted to make the movie because she was attracted to the duality of the script, because it shows two very different worlds, like the conservative buttoned up suit guys that we're supposed to believe Keanu Reeves
also
is a part
like
of.
The strong dudes.
And then also strong dudes, yeah. And then also like the surfer culture. So it was like she saw it as like system and anti-system, and that really drew her to the script. She saw Johnny Utah as an everyman somehow.
Yeah, I always thought it was interesting that Johnny Utah as a name, because he's an ex-quarterback of Ohio State. Which is just like not a very greatly veiled reference to Joe Montana, right?
Did he play for Ohio State?
No.
Oh, okay.
He played for the 49ers, I believe.
No,
in college.
I don't know where he played, but maybe.
But that's like pitching,
Notre
like,
Dame.
I want to make a movie that's kind of like Indiana Jones about an ex-archaeologist and like, you know, swashbuckler adventure hero, and I'm going to call him New Mexico James. You know what I mean?
I mean, you might have to explain it each time you tell people
right.
Why you've chosen
that. You're going
to
have all of everything you just said is going to have to be written on the poster.
Yes.
Because then that'll be out. People are like, oh, I see the connection.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the motto of the film.
Very clever send-up you just did. And Catherine Bigelow also was really gunning for Keanu Reeves specifically. Like, the studio wanted other actors. I think Charlie Sheen was originally going to be in it, and then Johnny Depp was also somebody they were looking at. And Keanu Reeves wasn't a star yet at this point. He had done Bill and Ted, and that's pretty much it. I think maybe Quicksilver.
Other notable, Matthew Broderick, Val Kilmer, and Willem Dafoe.
Wait. Wait, hold on.
Johnny Utah.
That was anyone.
Willem Dafoe is not Johnny Utah. That would be.
Oh, I was going to say.
But yeah. Val Kilmer or Matthew Broderick could have each been Johnny Utah?
Yes.
Okay, that's fantastic.
Yes.
If you're familiar with Point Break Live, which has been in Los Angeles for a very long time, I think it's in New York still, but Point Break Live is basically, they do a live version of this, of the movie, and it's obviously abbreviated, but what they do is they just cast somebody from the audience to play Johnny Utah, because in their theory, anyone can do it. And so everyone who comes that day, they just pick somebody out of the audience, male or female, and they get to play that role. And somebody just walks around with them and feeds them their lines as they go. And it's flawless. Like, it works perfectly. So he really is every man.
Right. He's a blank canvas.
He's so blank and unemotional in the movie that it's very easy to just play Keanu Reeves.
Yeah. I love how many scenes they are. There's like two or three different scenes where Lori Petty, who plays Tyler, is looking at him saying, "You have that look in your eyes." And it's like the Keanu look like... And then later she's like, "See, that look in your eyes is gone. You actually look happy." And he's like...
Yeah, Patrick Swayze says he's got his own demons to deal with, don't you, Utah? And it's just nothing going on. If you're curious who Bryce Petty is, she's the love interest in this movie. She used to date Bodie, who's like the main antagonist, and that's Patrick Swayze. And now she's into Johnny Utah. And it's never really clear why, other than he pretends to be an orphan and her own parents were killed.
Yeah, that's it. And she never talks about her own parents. Like,
yeah,
he reads
I didn't
that
know
in a file.
Her own parents were killed.
They read that in a file where he's like looking for like a way in. He's like,
I missed that, I guess. Because I was just like, why is she obsessed with that? Because she also gets mad at him. She's like, are you an orphan? Like, when he's like,
right, when she shoots a bullet 3 inches from his face to wake him up.
Be honest, how many times did you fall asleep in this movie?
Like a couple times.
Right, yeah, just like quick.
But I always rewound it and I watched it.
Rewound? Did you watch it on VHS?
Yeah, I watched it on VHS because it was 1992 when the movie was made.
She did have a more authentic experience then if she was watching it on tape.
I've seen this movie several times. It's a movie that I genuinely love. I think is fantastic. When I was first dating my now wife, I told her about Point Break because she had never seen it before and how great it was. But I failed to emote how ironically I love it. And so she just watched it with her family during a Christmas break once, where she was like, oh, Soren loves this movie. Let's watch it. And these people I've never met before and I'm trying to make a good impression with.
That's all they know.
And then she called me afterwards. She's like, that's not a good movie. And I was like, who did you watch it with? And she's like, I don't know, my sister and my grandma. And I was like, no, no! Oh, you should have watched it with me. You'd love it.
I would talk over the whole thing. It would be great.
Yeah. Well, I would just watch you watch it. Isn't that comfortable?
I want to talk about some production stuff, unless you want to keep talking about casting.
No, the only other interesting thing I had was that they originally wanted Patrick Swayze to play Johnny Utah, but he didn't want to. Yeah. He turned it down. I was like, well, I'll just be Bodhi. And then once that happened, they never considered anybody
else.
Also,
he had finished Ghost at this time.
Yeah.
And he was actually, he missed a lot of the filming. Like when he's got the Reagan mask on and he's running in the foot chase and such, that's not even Patrick Swayze doing that. That's, he was gone.
Well, it's Ronald Reagan.
It's Ronald Reagan. yeah, it's just a stuntman. Because he was off doing like post-production stuff and marketing for Ghost. Not that interesting, but true. I want to show a clip specifically of when Swayze jumps out of the plane, and he said, right after he says, adios, amigo.
What? Pull the shit, Bodhi!
You are crazy!
Pull the fucking show!
Why don't you pull it?
No games, Bodhi! Pull the cord now!
Nah, you pull it! Go ahead, Johnny, pull it! You gotta drop the gun, right? If you use your other hand, what are you gonna hold on with?
Pull it right now! Or I blow your fucking head off and pull it myself!
The only way it's gonna happen, my friend. Do it!
I swear to God I will!
Do it, man! Do it or you're gonna die, Johnny!
Something that's interesting about this whole thing. First off, Swayze actually is just crazy. He did that. He jumped out of a plane. Because he, at the time, he was an amateur skydiver. So that is not a stuntman. Obviously, the close-up shots are just
no
like...
way to fake
just imagine...
Shot.
My favorite thing about filmmaking is like when you do a close-up shot, you don't need much. So what they probably did is they probably put the camera like... They're in a like lot, like a parking lot. And they put the camera on the ground and lifted it up so you'd see blue sky. And then they just like put Swayze and Keanu on like a box and then just blew a fan at them. So they're just like, whee! Like Superman in the way. And that's how you get those shots because they're not going to like drop a guy with a steady cam. And like, that's not how filmmaking works.
Yeah, I read for some of the other shots where it's the whole group falling. They made a crane specifically, like a crane.
Yeah, that like follows them. Yeah,
them. But
yeah.
they're still fake.
For the other sequence, but not for this
right,
one.
Right.
And then the other thing is if you guys remember, there's an episode of Mythbusters that actually tested out whether or not Bodhi and Utah would been able to free fall for that amount of time and like live because it's like 5, 4 and he goes and he throws the gun and he pulls the cord and then they hit the ground and they're like they would be dead,
like yeah
they'd be real dead.
Yeah, they pull the last minute.
Yeah, they pull it like with 5 seconds at maximum velocity. That it does
yes,
nothing.
Yes, because at 6 seconds Patrick Swayze said we're about to be shit waffles.
Yes.
There's a lot of phrases in this movie that they were trying out that never caught on.
Yeah, they really wanted some stuff to stick from this movie that never did.
Just never did.
Why would they be shit waffles?
Yeah. Hey, I'm on it like stink on shit is one of the things that they say in this movie.
Well, there's. I guess we're going to bring it up later, so I'll
yeah, we'll bring it up later. The last thing I want to mention about this clip, though, is that the wind speed is so drastic that they would not be able to hear each other. So that conversation should go more like, pull the chute, Bodhi! What? I can't hear you! Do it or you're gonna die! I literally can't hear what you're saying! Even though they're like right up against each other.
What?
Huh?
What?
Why are you, we're gonna die! We're gonna die! Like just everyone saying the same
thing. Yeah, we're in the sky!
Yeah.
Or somebody just goes, should I pull it?
Should I pull it? Yeah. You should pull it!
I can't understand.
I think I'm gonna pull the chute though because we're getting pretty close to the ground.
There's a lot in that scene where, clearly they are skydiving for a lot of it, and it's maybe not those two necessarily, but where we're those like long shots where we can actually see the two of them.
Oh yeah.
And one of the guys isn't wearing a parachute, and there's no way to hide a parachute there. How do they do that? Abe?
I don't know.
They just,
I have no answer.
They just threw a guy out of an airplane.
My argument would be that you have a skinnier person and the baggy clothes that they have a hidden smaller suit. Because there's actually suits that you can have that have the parachute in them instead of a strap.
So there's a secret person.
So it's a secret. The secret parachute. Secret. I guess. Oh, my, I thought you said my idea. I don't know. This is not true. I don't know.
I thought you said a secret person was in the parachute.
Yeah, there's a tiny. That's how parachutes
he's
work.
He's gonna burst through the back and just start flapping his arms. Really, really.
That's how all parachutes work, though. You like just say, "Hey, guy, can you open it for me?" And they're like, "Yes." It's like ah, pushes it out. It's a team of gnomes.
The foot chase scene.
Oh yeah.
If you guys remember, it's the where Keanu is just chasing after Swayze, and they're going all across backyards and through people's houses. And the way they filmed that was they built a special camera that's basically a Steadicam, which is the camera that they use for long like tracking shots and it just stays level. They put one of those on a pole with a little equalizer to keep it from shaking, and they just had the camera operator hold the pole and just sprint as fast as he could after these guys as they're running through people's backyards. And that's how they did that.
Yeah.
There are some really incredible shots in this movie. That chase scene is outstanding. It's better than like amazing, a Bourne. Yeah. Even in Bourne, you can't really tell what's going on. This is very clear at every point what's happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the tracking is, and like the editing's perfect. And then it's also, it goes uncredited, I think, but the very first scene of this movie, well, other than the just watching the waves, is Johnny Utah showing up at the FBI facility, and it's just this long tracking shot through the whole FBI facility. It's like a Paul Thomas Anderson shot.
Yeah,
yeah, it's a Aaron Sorkin walk and talk.
Yeah, it's amazing. But instead of like Aaron Sorkin, like this beautiful pithy dialogue, instead it's like you're young, dumb, and full of cum, and like that's it.
Yeah.
Oh, you guys haven't seen Point Break.
It just really sticks out.
Assholes and chicken skin and donuts, all like within 5 minutes of showing up to the office for the first time.
It's Catherine Bigelow's highest grossing film until Zero Dark Thirty. That's 21 years.
This is also her first big like Hollywood success.
Yeah, she doesn't have that many names or that many titles to her belt, but now she does, and she will.
Right.
Continue.
Yeah. Before this, it was what Near Dark and
Strange Days.
No, Strange Days came after.
What about that military bomb Steel movie? Wasn't that hers?
K-19 Widowmaker.
No.
Yes. K-19 Widow.
Hurt Locker.
Hurt Locker.
Yeah.
Thank
you.
That was hers. You called bomb.
Yeah, military bomb movie.
Military bomb movie. That was much later.
I thought you said Bomberman for some reason. I was like, they're making Bomberman.
This came out. Point Break came out in the theater the week after Terminator 2 was released, and Terminator 2 was directed by James Cameron. And he and Catherine Bigelow were still married at this time, and he has an executive producer credit on this film. So, man, those couple of weeks, he was just like, all of the money for James.
For James.
It's all for me.
King of the ocean.
Yeah.
Wait, these two movies were out simultaneously?
Yeah.
So, oh my God. And it was a huge box office success, right? This movie?
Yes. Well, yeah. Wow. For a movie of its type and scale, yeah.
Yeah, they were going to make a sequel in 1993. I did some research. in 1993, but then they didn't. And I don't know why, because they actually did really well in the box office.
Yeah, it cost $24 million to make, and the opening box office run was $83.5 million, which is pretty good for 91. It's since become a cult following, so it's made much more than that.
Yeah, definitely.
And I don't even think that includes international, which is now a market.
And then, like, what wound up becoming the film that you watched, Carmen, the 2015
that great 2015 classic?
Yes, yeah, released on Christmas Day for some reason.
Of course, what other day would that kind of a film be released on?
Yes,
truly,
it's true. They resurrected talks of doing a sequel, but then of course Patrick Swayze died. They were going to do, like, years later after that 1993 plan fell through. They were like, well, let's try it again now that everybody's a little bit older. And the idea was going to have Bodhi like not actually be dead in the end. He like comes back, and then it's a whole thing. But then
that would have made a
Bodhi
lot of
actually
sense.
Died. So.
That would have made a lot of sense for the 2015 film, guys. I have my own agenda here.
Meanwhile, the people who make Ghost are all of a sudden like, oh, we should do a sequel.
Ghost 2.
Too soon. Too soon.
Oh, so you've all seen Ghost, but not Point Break.
Yeah. He comes back to help them make Point Break, too. It was nominated for 3 very prestigious awards.
Which was?
It was nominated for the MTV Movie Award for Most Desirable Male.
Wait, I guess who it is?
Yes, you may.
Okay. Is it Patrick Swayze?
Yes.
Yes! It could have gone either way, because Keanu Reeves is hot as shit in this movie.
Well, Soren, let me tell you something else. It was nominated for another award... Most Desirable Male, Keanu Reeves.
So,
And then also best action sequence for the final skydiving scene.
Who won the most desirable male?
Do you guys want to guess? Which one do you guys think won?
Yeah, I think it's gotta be Spacey.
You're all fucking wrong.
My guy?
It was Keanu.
Yeah! He's got such a confusing body in this movie.
You're all wrong. It was Gary Busey.
I know, I was like, I was
Dark
Gary
Horse.
Busey.
Busey came in at the end.
Keanu's got like, his body goes back and forth between being very, very strong and then kind of skinny. For a while, he just wears this like weird half purple wetsuit. Like when he gets his ass beat by Anthony Kiedis in this movie, he wears like this weird hat. It's like a black vest over a purple turtleneck t-shirt, basically. And he's this skinny little guy. And then later in the movie, when after he, his girlfriend tries to shoot him in the head, he's sitting on the edge of the bed and he's just yoked, like crazy yoked, like bigger than Patrick Swayze. He's just, his fluctuation is, it doesn't make any sense in this movie.
Well, it's because... Because, you know, when at the point in a relationship, I guess, when somebody shoots you close to your head, you get super yoked.
It was all that surfing. Like, it's just in that early scene, he hadn't done surfing yet. And then on, it's all the surfing, bro.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Surfing does that for you.
Surfing makes you stronger than the FBI.
It does. The water blasted. It chiseled his muscles.
Like a chiseler with marble, except it's Reeves. Oh, Reeves.
You don't have any comeback for that, Tom?
Like a chiseler with marble. No, I got nothing.
You know, like Michelangelo.
Yeah, he's Michelangelo's David. Michelangelo's Keanu. Same expression.
Chiseler with marble. What? I don't understand. You guys are acting like this is not a term. They just used that fart term or whatever it was.
Blue flame special.
Blue flame special. So in the movie, I just got to take a second for this because it's so interesting.
Do it.
I watched it again last night, and at the beginning, the Agent Harp, who's Keanu Reeves' boss, calls him at the beginning a blue flame special. And I was like, what the fuck is that? And so I looked it up, and it's not anywhere. And so then I had to like dissect the words. And what he's calling him is based on a blue plate special, which is something it's always the cheapest plate at a restaurant. And then also a blue flamer, which is somebody who lights their farts on fire. So basically what he's calling him is a cheap fart at the beginning.
Not any of the top shelf farts.
Yeah. No, that's such a good insult.
He's the well farts.
The well farts. Yes, I'll take the bottom shelf of your farts.
But he's a blue flame special. So he's like, he thinks he's special, but he's just a cheap fart. But I was like, oh, that's so good. Let's bring that back.
He thinks he's special, but he's actually just one of the farts that comes in a plastic bottle that's like an inch off the ground.
It's just been like kept around, you know, just in the back.
I like thinking that Catherine Bigelow didn't even know what that was, but she was just like, whatever, leave it in.
I just thought he fucked the lineup.
I bet she was just super into it. She's like, that fucking cheap fart.
A cheap fart's going to get sexiest man. I just know it.
I want to segue and talk about what the film is really about.
All right, so we talked about how the film was made.
Uh-huh.
Now let's talk about some special hidden stuff that you might not have noticed.
What do we call the segment?
Hidden bullshit.
Secret things. So there's some symbolism you may or may not have noticed. Actually, this one's not really a symbol because I still don't understand why Bigelow chose to do this, but there's something that people have noticed about the movie is that the four ex-presidents, that gang, they're killed in chronological order of when the respective president served office. So LBJ dies first, then Nixon, then Carter, then Reagan. I don't know why there's any reason for this.
It's a good choice. I love it.
Just a small little thing. Yeah, I guess. I mean, that's just, now you know.
She snuck that one in there for all the nerds.
Yeah, for all the nerds.
The presidential nerds who are watching this surf movie?
Where's Dan O'Brien?
I was about to say, I guarantee you Dan noticed that. Yeah.
Dan's like, he wrote it down in his journal. Yeah. He has a president journal.
He's really bored smart until the president parts.
Yeah, really comes alive when the presidents are on screen. Okay, so I've got a couple of things about this. The opening credits kind of roll in and out across the screen like waves. Oh. The movie's about waves, you guys.
God, this is such a good movie.
It is. Yeah.
There's cadence.
They do. Yeah. They do.
Good catch.
Yeah. Also, the two main characters along those wave lines, because wave lines, because they're, you know, their names like start on either side of the screen
and they crash,
and they cross over, and it's like, whoa.
It's almost like a point
Point Break. You're like, that's super deep. But seriously, the two main characters do represent opposing ideological and philosophical forces that do crash into each other like waves and eventually break like points.
That's my favorite thing about points.
Yeah, that's
how they break.
Yeah. Constantly breaking. So, like, you know, Bodhi obviously represents the spiritualism side, but he eventually eschews sort of all pretense of being spiritual and then just kind of goes for the vault. Like, he greedily goes for the vault. He imprisons Tyler. He just becomes a completely self-serving monster. And then, conversely, Utah trades in, like, his clean-cut, by-the-books conservative lifestyle for the liberal surfer life, and then throws his badge into the ocean. He's like, fuck this bra.
Gets a new haircut.
Yeah, lets it grow out.
Says bra a lot. He really does.
He does, yeah. I love it when he catches the invisible insect on that guy's... My favorite parts of this movie are the parts where Keanu goes full Keanu.
There's a whole scene where they have to go collect hair from different surfers around the beach.
Yeah.
And they're coming up with, like... It's a very silly montage. And yeah, one of them
they have to get the toxicology report on, like, where are these... surfers,
and it perfectly showcases the differing investigative techniques of Keanu Reeves and Gary Busey. Like, Keanu Reeves comes up on this dude, he's like, "Whoa, bro, you got like a real stinger on your head," whatever he said, and he like pretends to grab a bug so he can like pull some hair out of this guy's head. He's like, "I just saved your life, bro," and then he like walks off. Gary Busey sprints up to a pair of strangers on the beach and then just immediately stabs at them with scissors and cuts their hair off.
Yeah. He shows up on the beach, shows them his badge, and then cuts a man's hair.
And then runs off.
Like, and my favorite part about that is after he leaves, the two of them, one of them is like thankful. Like,
he's like, he didn't bust us.
He could have busted us for smoking weed. And he's like, yeah, but my hair.
Instead, he stole our hair. Yeah.
Also, I still don't understand. They were just trying to get DNA. To me, it was very confusing.
DNA wasn't really even a thing then.
They were just getting evidence that there were surfers at the beach.
No, they wanted to know. They had discovered one of the guards at a bank had pulled some of the hair out of the ponytail of one of the ex-presidents and discovered that in the toxicology report that there were all these like weird minerals and like dangerous things in there that was from toxic dumping in the ocean. So they had to find out where the location was that these guys were surfing, and they were going to do that by the toxicology report of the matching hair from the surfers at those spots.
Yeah. Which, once again, the FBI is happy to pay for.
But, yeah.
To
but
make
they
sure
also,
that we get these four
so
guys.
They had DNA evidence. They had DNA evidence of who, they could look it up in a system, right?
It was a different time, Carmen.
Yeah. No, it wasn't. It was the right time for DNA evidence. They used it.
Also,
oh, my God.
Like, besides, the scene is... needs to be unpacked and for several different reasons. Besides the fact that Gary Busey just comes spidering up and steals their hair like Rumpelstiltskin, you see in the background like two big cooling towers. Like there's like a nuclear power plant right on the beach in this scene. What beach is that?
That's Dockweiler.
So that's a real place.
Yeah, so Dockweiler Beach is, if you've never been, you all live in LA. Dockweiler Beach is like, it's right next to a sewage treatment facility. And if you catch the wind just right, it's really terrible there. But it's one of the only beaches where they let you put fires on the beach at night. So like, that's where everybody goes. And in the background-
it's a trash beach. It's like, yeah, fuck it, burn it, we don't care.
Those, yeah, they're like, whatever. We used to go there and like, you find knives in the sand and stuff like that. It's not a pleasant
just
place.
Knives.
But it's, yeah, just upstream is this toxic, like, sewage treatment facility with these two big smokestacks coming out of it. Not good surfing there, by the way.
Of course, that's the one Gary Busey picked. I'm going to go down here to scalp these people.
Scalp.
You know, he tried that at least once.
I also love there's the shots of when he's like watching, Busey is watching Utah, and they're like talking via comms, and they're like, did you do the cop stuff? And then he's got the binoculars, and he loses sight of him. And he acts like a crazy unhinged man because all he does is he's just like pacing back and forth in his car. I don't know how he actually, that's possible. But he's like putting down the binoculars, putting them back on, and he's just like scared because he can't see a thing for like 2 seconds.
Where's my friend? Where's my friend?
And then he gets out of his car and he just runs through traffic. And at one point, he points at a car like, you need to stop because I'm still going to walk.
See, Gary Busey has no object. Permanence.
No, he does. He just, like, like a goldfish?
Utah could be in fucking Jupiter for all he knew right now. He's like, good God, we have to find him.
Yeah. Like, dear God. Yeah. He just starts scalping.
And
people.
Actually, he's just behind some bushes getting beat up by Anthony Kiedis.
Yeah.
And War Child, the black white supremacist.
Yes.
Which confused the hell out of me.
Yeah, yeah. They go and attack. The white supremacists attack him for being in their waves. And the white supremacists, not all of them are white.
Right. Their leader, War Child, is not white. At least he super doesn't look it.
He got kicked out of the supremacist band.
Okay. I've got a theory. I think that the story that Utah gives Tyler about, you know, when he goes through the burger stand or whatever that she works at, and he's like, I'm always living my life for other people, and other people's goals wind up becoming my goals, and then I couldn't do it until my parents died. Like, I think that's actually his life story, apart from his parents dying in a car accident. Like, he's a scholarship, football scholarship student. He got hurt, and he goes to law school, and then he's in the FBI. But he's clearly
a thrill seeker.
Well, he's clearly ill at ease. Like, he doesn't fit in the FBI. And I don't know. I mean, it could just be a brilliantly subtle performance by Keanu, or it just could be really good casting. But it's clear that he's not where he's supposed to be. And then as the movie progresses, like, his parent figure dies, like Angelo dies, who's kind of like a mentor figure to him. And then as he's doing his undercover stuff, he realizes that he doesn't want to be an FBI agent, and he actually does find a spiritual connection with surfing and the ocean. And so he figures out that lie that he told Tyler was actually true, that he was living his life for other people. And the only part of the story that was a lie was the fact that his parents were dead, which was a real big hang-up for Tyler, but... Yeah. You know?
A real bummer.
Her thing was like, my perfect guy is going to have dead parents.
No, won't even give him the time of day unless his parents are fucking dead.
Yeah. And then at the end when she found out he was lying, that was the first thing she asked. Not right. Like, right. You're an FBI agent. Well, she did. She was like, you're an FBI agent and your parents are dead.
Yeah, she spends way more time on the dead parents.
I was expecting them to be dead. I have to meet them? What's going on?
That's what she's worried about.
Yeah, not like meeting parents.
Yeah. Tyler really makes me anxious throughout the entire movie because her clothes are weird and I've never seen anything like them. She's right. Got a shirt that's not really a shirt. That's just sleeves that connect in the middle. I don't even know how to describe it. It's like battle armor, but instead it's neoprene.
It's off the shoulder. It's an off the shoulder shirt, right?
No, it has no back. It has no front. It's just arms. It's just
there
sleeves.
Has to be
and then there's a little
sliver
connection in the
and
middle.
And in the back, no, it's just
did
like,
I miss that?
They come to meet. Yeah.
Oh,
it's where he's just being a creep and spying on her, getting dressed by her car. Like, there's no, that does not aid his investigation in any way. He's just watching her get dressed.
Watches her change next to her car.
Yeah. Oh, I do right. remember that, but yeah. I didn't really.
And she's got a towel wrapped around her, and she drops her bathing suit, and you just know there's nothing under there.
Mm-hmm.
See, my reaction to that, though, she put on jean shorts right away, which right. to my thought was just like, ow, girl. Also, you had a swimsuit on, so your butt is still wet. Ow.
Yeah, there's likely some sand all over her.
Tons
and everything.
Of sand.
Oh, there's sand everywhere.
And then just jean shorts as she hops into her little convertible.
Uh-uh.
Without
uh-uh.
buttoning or zipping.
Well,
anything.
You can't. You can't when you do that, because it's nothing there and you're wet. I don't know. I think about the logistics of this. That looked painful.
That's legit.
It's that authenticity right you get from Catherine Bigelow. She knew, like, no, she's not buttoning those. No. Bodhi himself he's a cult leader, basically. He's a mockery of spiritualism. He represents what happens when spiritualism becomes corrupted, because he espouses, you know, stuff about love and peace and harmony and, you know, rekindling the human spirit and everything. But every single thing he does in the movie is completely self-serving. He's just bringing people in with his rhetoric and then using them to help him rob banks so he just doesn't have to get a job. So he sort of represents the way that spiritualism can be wielded against people. And I think Utah is obviously at first drawn in by that, but then he's like a lot of his anger towards Bodhi in the second half of the film, you know, obviously it's because he's kidnapped Tyler, but it's also because he feels personally betrayed because he's figured out that Bodhi's not a genuine person. He's just some fucking asshole who's like talking a big talk, but really he just doesn't want to work.
And he uses people against people. You know?
Yes, he does. Yeah,
like he's just a cult leader.
And
just
he keeps like
anything to convince you that
right.
I'm awesome.
And then he consistently distances himself from what's happening. Like he's like I like when he shows Utah the video of Tyler being held hostage. He's like, oh no, man, it's all like I can't like I hate violence. I could never do that. But like you know, Rosie, he's crazy. Rosie, by the way, is one of the cameramen from Wayne's World. he's like, I can't control him, and he does that. Like, he doesn't accept any responsibility for anything that happens. He's constantly distancing himself from it.
And when he's given the chance to, you know, like, back off on that, he goes for the money. Yet at the
goes
end,
for the safe. He doesn't release Tyler when he's like, yeah. You got what you wanted, release her. He throws the radio away and
but
dives out of the...
But somehow he seems consistent to me a little bit, it just with the very end, where he's like, you know, I'm not going to be in a good in a cage. Just let me take this 50, you know, year storm and just die. You know, like that's like a spiritual death to him.
It's sort of what
I have answers to all of this.
Well, real quick, not a joke answer, because the way look you're getting. That the ending actually kind of makes me mad a little bit, because I feel like the way to stick it to Bodhi would be to not let him have that.
But he didn't want to stick it to Bodhi.
Did he not?
It was his friend. Sort it was of, his yeah. weird, messed up friend. Yeah. Frenemy. I don't know.
His dad bro?
His dad bro.
His dad bro friend?
His dad bro friend.
I got to talk about this. So extras in movies. This movie takes the cake.
Extras get knocked down.
And the foot chase?
Yeah, in the foot chase. I mean, that happens in a lot of movies where somebody's running down the street and they're just blowing people down all over the place. This is in the foot chase. There are some people who, as they fall, make noises like, hey, what's going on? don't push me!
Why? And then you get like kicked multiple times.
Keanu body checks a lady out of the way.
Body checks
that
a lady. Another woman hits him with a broom. And then at one point, Patrick Swayze stops to throw a pit bull at Keanu Reeves.
Oh,
yes. We're going to unpack
that.
Don't get ahead of yourself.
One other thing I want to call out, since we're kind of in the bonus scene section, basically. Tom Sizemore is briefly in this film. That means something to a few people in here. He's when they do the drug bust on the house and Anthony Kiedis shoots himself in the foot, he's the DEA agent that was under, like, in deep Donnie Brasco cover there, and he's like super mad and screaming at him, and then he shows him his tattoo.
They get the wrong guys to start. They go after the wrong group, right. And it's the neo-Nazis that beat up Keanu Reeves. He probably knows it's the wrong guys, but because he got beat up, he's just got a vendetta. He's right. Like, let's
and
just
he almost
raid their fucking house.
He almost loses anyway. Like, War Child almost shoves his face into a lawnmower.
Yes. And Anthony Kiedis is there from Red Hot Chili Peppers, maybe playing himself, I don't know. And then for some reason, Tom Sizemore from Saving Private Ryan and some other incredible movies. Heat, yeah.
The Relic.
He's just...
2006 is The Relic.
1996, sir.
1996, I'm
He's
sorry.
He's there for 30 seconds and then not in the rest of the movie. But it doesn't follow the Law and Order rules, which is if you see a star at the beginning, oh, that guy's going to be important later. No, he just doesn't show up again.
You're really being gentle with Tom Sizemore by saying if you see a star. No, I want to know, because you see him, they peek into the window. He is busily pouring beer into a bowl of Cheerios for breakfast. Now, I know he's under deep cover. There is no one else in the room.
That's for him.
That's just for Tom. I want to see the series of events that led to that moment. Like, I want to see the episode one of that story. Like,
I mean, he got a tattoo for being undercover because they wouldn't believe him. And he was like, he points to it and he goes like, I got a fucking tattoo for this and you ruined my cover.
He was method act. He was method undercover.
Beer
yeah, he was porn. Method undercover. He's like, what would I be eating for breakfast? Yeah. Beer and cereal. Yeah.
What would a real piece of shit eat for breakfast?
That should have been the next Point Break. Is just following him through from day one undercover and like really trying to make it authentic. my friends have tattoos.
Here's what I want to get in now. We've made let's make some weird non-intuitive arguments. This is my favorite segment. We call it Let's Overthink It. And Soren, I want you to take the first volley.
Yeah, you had some questions about the end of this movie and what it means and like why that kind of ruined it for you.
Yeah.
That he lets him go back into the ocean. I think I might have an answer for that. I have a theory. Well, it's not even just mine. I have a friend, Christian Lynch, who originally brought this up, and I've only exacerbated it. But I think that this is the story of a Mormon finding enlightenment in Buddhism. And he's discovering that you shouldn't have these delusions of permanence, and that's what he gets by the end of the movie. And then Keanu Reeves enters Nirvana because he's his Bodhisattva.
Well, he did play Buddha in Little Buddha.
Yes, he did. So let me go through the clips that kind of prove this. You may be thinking, whoa, what do you mean Mormon? Well, let me tell you. Johnny Utah, his last name is Utah, first of all. He's from Ohio, which also had, for a long point in American history, had a big base of Mormonism. And if you go to the very beginning of this movie, when he's being shown around by Agent Harp, it's important to him that they don't drink caffeine, they don't ingest caffeine, they don't ingest sugar, they don't ingest cigarettes or booze. So these are all like real fundamental dietary restrictions of the Mormon church. Let's move on to the next point. Bodhisattva, they call him Bodhisattva in the movie. She says at the very beginning, the first time that he meets him. So I don't know if you're familiar with the idea of the Bodhisattva in Buddhism, but it's a person who's able to reach nirvana, but delays doing so out of compassion in order to save other suffering beings. And so he's clearly there just to teach enlightenment to Johnny Utah. And he's sticking around just to do that. Now, Bodhi also has a lot of other connections to like this weird Asian philosophies that they never really like address, but it's still evident in the movie. Like there's a clip of him fighting. Like he knows the kung fu of a Buddhist monk. Now, there's just one more thing that I want to bring up.
He said this was stimulating. Are we to assume that he was rock hard while he was doing that?
Yes.
Yeah, of course. And then at the very end of the movie, when after Keanu Reeves has gained enlightenment in this movie and Bodhisattva is no longer needed, he gains his own enlightenment. Now, he goes out into the ocean to catch this 50-foot wave and kind of disappear into the water forever. This moment's important because it means that he's entering a state of where he no longer is being reincarnated. So like in Buddhist philosophy, once you reach nirvana, there's no longer a reason to be reincarnated. So at the point where the strange Australian cop goes, "We'll get him when he comes back in." The last line of the movie is Keanu Reeves saying, "He's not coming back." Because this is his last incarnation before he enters nirvana, because now Keanu Reeves has become enlightened. It's not even that he's just not coming back, like, back to shore. He's not coming back to this earthly realm.
Well done.
That, I believe you.
Yeah, sorry, there's one more thing that I just wanted to add, that there's actual precedence for this, that there's a book that's very popular among the Mormon community of how similar Mormonism is to Buddhism, and how like you don't have to be one or the other, you can be both. And in some Mormon churches, they actually teach it, because there are so many people who are conflicted with the idea of, like, they become Mormon and then they get so enamored with the idea of Buddhism that they were like, they're not that different, they're basically the same thing, and you can be accepting of both of them. So there's precedent.
Well done. I wanted to toss it over to Carmen. She has
this is not going to be as impressive.
Interesting theory about meatball subs.
Yes, it's not really. Well, let's just watch. So, okay, I guess let's just play this moment, and then I'll go into it.
It's Calvin and Hobbes. It's funny.
Oranges, sir.
Take some oranges. You want some oranges?
Dollar, sir.
No.
Not
no.
Oranges.
No. Fake, we got luck. We got luck.
Dollar, sir.
No thanks. Good luck. It's time for lunch.
Angelo, it's 10:30.
Right around that corner, there is a sandwich shop. They sell meatball sandwiches. Best I've ever tasted. Would you go get me two? Thank you. Utah, get me two.
So they were on a stakeout, and he wanted a sandwich at 10:30 in the morning, and he's on a stakeout, and he brings his newspaper, and he reads the newspaper while they're on a stakeout, and he wants a sandwich, and it makes no sense, and they're terrible at their job, and he gets been so on, easily distracted.
He's been on this case, or not on this case, but in bank robbery crime
for
22 years.
For 22 years. This is his baby of, like, an assignment. This is his thing where he's like, I have this great conspiracy theory that these are surfers. These dead presidents are surfers. This means so much to him, but sandwiches mean more. And the distraction level of both of these guys, actually, because when I believe Reeves knows that the dead presidents have seen him and he knows who they are, and they grab him to take him skydiving, and then he gets like wrapped up in skydiving and how great skydiving is. Like, these guys are so easily distracted by sandwiches and skydiving and fun things, and I get it, because work, you know, but come on.
Yeah, I you're right, they're not good agents.
Yeah, they're very terrible.
But like clownish, like it conveniently to the plot terrible. Like, to me, this is like, they should have been fired so much earlier
Yeah, it does feel like that whole scene where they're on the stakeout is just improv, because Gary Busey is so adamant about him getting him two sandwiches.
Right.
He says it three times
in that
scene.
Yeah, he reminds him three times. Yeah.
Yeah, won't give it up. And surely that wasn't in the script, because how would that have made it past the editing process?
In fact, he gets angry later about his choice of two and says, I should have
got three. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's truly a sign of an unhinged man to ask for three sandwiches.
Yeah. Ask for three sandwiches at
10:30 in the morning. At 10:30 in the morning, and also, like, why
he's
would
reading
you
the funnies.
Like,
he has to
Marmaduke, man.
Gotta check in with Kathy.
But you're the only only eyes left, and the whole point of you guys sitting in this car is waiting for a Lincoln. And
right. To give you some backstory, they know this is the day this robbery will happen. It's not like they're just waiting out there for several days.
Yeah.
They know because these guys are disappearing in like three in the next day. Every single season, this is when they leave. And so there's one last bank that they have to get. They've seen the guys at that bank already.
And they know they're they're just methodical about it. So they probably attack rob banks at around the same time. Usually 10:30 in the morning. Like, one could probably have that in the arrest reports or the crime scene stuff.
It is really, really baffling.
All these problems could have been solved by Busey just packing a lunch.
I think both of these guys just love the drama. Like, they just love it. I think they're like, he's sitting there and he's like, get me a sandwich. Yeah, I definitely need this sandwich, but also I gotta read my newspaper. I hope they come. And then also he jumps out of the airplane and he's like, oh, I'm so mad at you guys for being the dead presidents, and I know you know that I know you know, and you know that I know you know, but this is so fun, jumping out of the airplane. Like, it's just like, this is their kicks. This is what they love, and they're having fun, and they're never going to solve this case until they have to.
Well said.
Well said, yeah. I think that's true. I think it's delightful that Nixon is the only robber that robs in character.
Right. None of them do a voice, and he does.
None of them are doing it, and he's like, I'm going to rob the bank. Like,
yeah. That's
true. I'm a crook at one point, he says.
LBJ isn't wandering around talking about his big dick and looming over people.
Yeah.
What's the next clip?
Reagan is constantly forgetting why he's there.
Yeah. Oh, I think we're supposed to. Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Oh,
oh no.
Oh.
Soren, I think you got one coming up about Johnny Utah. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No.
FBI robot?
That's me.
Oh, it's you.
That's me. Okay. I think Johnny Utah's some kind of FBI robot.
Well,
all right, let's move on.
Because he just sort of says his emotions rather. Let's show the clip. Like, watch where he gets hurt here.
Oh, oh no! Oh! Yes!
Tyler, look, I fucked up, okay? I know I fucked up. I wanted to tell you, but I couldn't. I was afraid you'd leave. Good guess, huh? Fuck, why can't I ever say what I really mean?
Because you're a robot. He's a robot. It's not in his program.
That should go on his gravestone. Why can't I ever say what I really mean?
I thought it was amazing because you both independently sent me your thoughts on what clips we should show.
Yeah.
You also had one where you were just taken back by Keanu's tour de force.
It's truly a delayed response. We'll just watch this response now.
I want to prepare you that I added some because I found some more. There's like a few other surprises.
This is how he deals with no.
This helps my thesis too.
God damn it!
They actually bump his reset button right there.
Yeah, it really feels like there's like a delayed response, especially with that like, shoot. No!
Because they cut to him in between shotgun blasts. Like, it's boom, and they cut to him. He's like, like, wait, I want to see how this turns out so I can react accordingly.
This isn't right. What do I do?
He's trying to decode it.
And then he holds it too long because like the run also is just like doo-doo-doo-doo-doo. Like, it's just like he stood there and went, no! And then stopped and then ran.
It goes like in terms of like Wrath of Khan, no. Like, it's the length, the duration of the no is so long.
He Shatners it up.
It might be the longest no of all cinematic history.
Yeah, that scene where he's in the bank and he's saying, get your hands off me. He's emotionally shattered at that point because first of all, his his Bodhi, like his father figure, has betrayed him in this religion that he thought he belonged to. And he's just watched another cop die. And now he's in handcuffs and he's been forced to participate in a bank robbery. And the one take that they went with was that one of him going, "Get your hands off me." And then after that, Catherine Bigelow was just like, "Yeah, we got in the can. That's it. Like, don't even want a second one. That'll do."
Yeah, like, she saw it was like, blank canvas.
I also love the last one where I'm an FBI agent, because it's simultaneously all cadence and zero cadence at the same time. Because it's like, I'm unsure of how every word is, every syllable is a whole roller coaster for me.
I'm an
I'm an FBI agent. It's just so much.
It's like I feel like there's like a slight and invisible question mark after every single thing. Like, I am an FBI agent. Yep. Yeah, that's it.
Got it. Got through it.
Yeah, man, it's wild. Well, does anyone else have anything to add?
No.
No? Anyone in the audience have any questions?
Scene that I wanted to see was Keanu telling the doctor from Scrubs how he left a crime scene where his partner was murdered and then convinced him to send him around the world chasing a single bank robber.
Oh my God, you're right.
I really wanted to see that scene. I just want to see him. Yeah. How convincing is he in that scene?
Right, because where we last left Dr. Cox, he was unconscious in a bank.
Right.
Just because Gary Busey had just punched him.
By Busey. Again, unhinged.
To take a prisoner and then release him.
Yeah, that's a great
scene.
That's
a very good question. It's probably a very difficult conversation.
And he also has to answer to his superiors about all this money that they're using.
Oh, shit, it's Cody.
Ah, fuck.
I just have a question. I've been thinking about this the entire time. When you were talking about... So it was about skateboarding originally, right?
Yes.
For a while. But the guy had the idea from watching Surfers. So, like, do you know what happened there? Like, he saw the Surfers, and then he's like, he pitched the movie, and they're like, okay, do it with skateboards. And they did it with skateboards, and do the surfer thing again.
No, well, I think he accidentally invented skateboarding. So what he did is he saw the Surfers, and he's like, guys, what if we put a little tiny wheels on them? Like, four of them. And then that's the movie.
I am satisfied with that answer.
Yeah, he thought he invented it. What if we were to surf the pavement in this movie? You mean like skateboarding? Yeah.
Like a board of skating, yes.
I mean, we wanted to do it in California because of the ocean, right? I mean, you could do skateboarding anywhere. Like, this is me being the guy who's like, why?
Well, the street's like a concrete ocean.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is.
So it's still in California?
Yeah.
I actually think I might actually have an answer for it, is that he may have gotten the idea while watching surfing, but realizing that that's a much harder film to make because you have to, you need a bigger budget, you have to shoot in the water, you have to have underwater shots.
Have to teach Patrick Swayze how to surf.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, trivia fact is Lori Petty, who plays Tyler, she is, the instructor of Keanu for how to, this is how you surf, you're going to kill yourself. She had never been in the ocean before the film was made. She had
Perfect.
Never been in the ocean.
Was she afraid of it, or she just never had the opportunity?
I don't know if she... It's just a...
Oh, that's
trivia.
Wonderful.
I think maybe she just lived in Ohio.
Yeah. You know? Well, she looked really natural. I believe
she looked natural. Yeah. I mean, they
convincing
trained her.
Performance.
I don't even understand how the movie would have worked with skateboarding, because it's so important to have all the stuff of it's you and the wave and the mysticism of it and the religion of it. It would have been really, really tough to pull that off in a skate park.
Yeah, was his name still going to be Bodhi, or would it have been like Skate Punk 219?
Wait. Do you think that's how skateboarders are named?
I just watched this movie. I know nothing about skateboarding.
In Carmen's defense, they do all have secret agent names, like Bodhi and Gromit and...
Yeah, Warchild.
Warchild.
Roach.
That famous Roach. Secret agent Gromit.
Gromit, yeah. Well, they all have code names.
Yeah, that's true.
That is one of my favorite lines in the movie, by the way, was when Swayze says, "Back off, Warchild."
Yeah, it does feel very much like a compound then. Like that, yeah. These are all... It's like he's at Burning Man the way that he says it. Back off, Warchild. This isn't your fight. Yeah, it's pretty wonderful the way that he uses everybody's names throughout it.
I also like that he goes, "Seriously." During that scene, he goes, "Back off, Warchild. Seriously."
like sensitive.
Like, really nice. Like, yeah. It's actually, like, I'm not joking right now. I normally am, but I'm not right now. No fights.
Look, Warchild, I know I can be a barrel of laughs sometimes. Now is not one of those moments.
I'm a real cut up. I know it's hard to take seriously.
War child. Yeah, and also if it was about skateboarding, it couldn't be called Point Break, right?
No, it was originally called Johnny Utah.
If it was about skateboarding, I think it would be called like Sick Ollie or something like that. I don't know.
Sick Ollie.
I'm trying to think of the.
Just sounds like a movie about a man with an illness.
Yeah. Ollie, I'm Sick Ollie. Yeah. It's a silly joke.
I really like that, though.
Sick Ollie. Well, Tom's done. And I broke Soren.
Well, I'm trying to think of the title now. I'm trying to think of what it would be. Take it to the vert. Just call it coping.
I don't know enough about skateboarding.
Oh, sorry. nor does our audience. There's in a half pipe, the real rail at the top is called coping.
And solid. Beating the grind, maybe? I don't know. Fuck you guys, I'm done. No,
it really wouldn't have been a good movie. All right, well, any other questions from you guys? Yeah, we got one.
I was just wondering, what do you think would be the skateboarding equivalent of Patrick Swayze paddling out into the ocean at the end and not coming back?
Sketching on the back of a Domino's pizza truck.
Yeah.
Yes.
What's the perfect skate that only comes along every 50 years?
50-year skate.
Maybe a truck drops a giant tube in the middle of the highway. And he's like, I've been waiting for this forever.
Yeah, I like it being really low stakes. Like, we know that Mr. Netterman only drains his pool every 15 years. We know it's coming up again, and we're going to get there.
All right, so we're done here, I think. We're out of time.
Yeah, that's it.
And we want to talk to you about how you can talk to us. We've obviously been recording this. This is just as much for you guys in front of me than it is for our listeners. But make sure to check us out on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Cracked Movie Pod. Please hit us up with your thoughts. We've been Abe, Tom, Carmen, Soren. Plug yourselves. Where can we find you online and such?
You can find me online at, obviously on Cracked. We do a lot of fun things, and you'll just see us if you go there. But you can also find me on Twitter at Soren_LTD. Or you can just come by my house. I got a kid. He's real fun.
Yeah, you can find me on Cracked. Or you can find me on Twitter at Carmesan Cheeses. And you could just look at my website, carmenangelica.com. So that's about it, right? Yeah, that's good.
Cool. Thank you guys.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for coming out to the first live Crack Movie Club.
Yeah.
Thank you guys so much for showing up.
What is up? This is Andrew T., host of the Yo, Is This Racist podcast. If you need help dealing with your racist family, your racist coworkers, this is the podcast for you. Yes, even white people. This week, check out my episode with Brett Gelman and Janixa Bravo. They made a great movie called Lemon.
Yeah. I hate being in like white spaces where the hip hop is playing super loud, and I'm like, I'm the only person of color here, and I know there's some, yeah. I know there's some browns in the kitchen.
Yeah.
So it's like, if your front of the house is all white, you don't get hip hop.
Listen to Yo, Is This Racist on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. Peace.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.